everyone. This is Josh Nason's Punch-Out here on WrestlingObserver.com. I'm, of course, Josh Nason, writer, editor, and podcaster for the website. This is episode 74. Can you believe? Actually, 73. Excuse me, 73. And it is a big one. UFC 214 coming up this Saturday night from the fabulous Honda Center in Anaheim, California. I'll have to take their word for it because I've actually never been. Big event. Huge event. If you have some money in the bank and you've been like, I need to cash it in. I need to spend some on a pay-per-view. This is the one to do it. Forget Mayweather McGregor. Find another way to watch it. Wait a week to watch on Showtime. Follow along round by round on our site. But if you have money and you're like, you know what? I got 60 bucks and it's time to do something fun, you know? Time to do something fun. Spend some money. Watch some fighting. Your friends are like, I have nothing going on. I need something to do. Come over. Buy this event. This is going to be really good. If you're an MMA fan, this is what you've been waiting for. This is what I've been waiting for. Five great fights on pay-per-view. The undercard, the prelims are really fun too. But this is it. Five great fights on pay-per-view. I'm going to knock on wood to hope everything comes to fruition on Saturday night. We have John Jones, Daniel Cormier too. We have a light heavyweight, essentially a title eliminator coming up, actually opening up the show. Robbie Lawler and Donald Cerrone. Tyron Woodley, Damian Maia for the welterweight title, and that should be some fun. And we also have Christine Cyborg Santos. I keep saying Santos. Justino, Lady Cyborg, going for the women's 145-pound title, the vacant title, against the vast underdog, Tony Evinger. Should be a hell of a main card, lots of newsworthy stuff, and I'm sure we'll be talking a lot about it afterward. But before we get there, we got to talk about the show itself. We got to preview the show, and joining me is Mr. California, the California Kid himself. Not Uriah Faber, but Josh Gross. Josh Gross is obviously a longtime writer in the sport, someone that's been on this show before. He's a published author. He's also a podcaster. So we talked to him about all kinds of stuff, UFC 214, even 60 Good Seconds on Mayweather McGregor, and also about the renewed interest in his book and the Ali Inoki fight, the podcast itself, and also some other fun things along the way. So I'm going to get out of the way and say without further ado, let's welcome Josh Gross to Josh Nason's Punch-Out. Well, UFC 214 coming up this weekend, and no better person to help us preview the card, a Californian guy out on the West Coast, and this obviously is card happening in California. And overall good guy, expert in everything, an author. He's been a guest on this show before. Welcome back to our airways. Boy, this podcasting stuff is tough, Josh. Josh Gross joining us on the other line. He is an author and a podcaster himself. And since we last spoke to you, I believe you were just launching the show, but we'll talk about that in a minute. But I have a more important question for you first, Josh. Have you ever been asked or told at a press conference, you know, I really don't like you, Josh, so I'm not going to answer your question?
At a press conference, well, I've had some fighters I thought that kind of like joked around with me a little bit. I've had some fighters face-to-face tell me they didn't like me and they didn't want to talk to me, for sure. It kind of comes with the territory, I think. But yeah, Luke Thomas got a little rough from John Jones today, didn't he?
Yeah. Yeah, we're talking about, for those that have not seen it, that the official UFC 214 press conference in Anaheim today. Luke Thomas asked a question, and John Jones simply said, I really don't like you, Luke, so I'm not going to answer your question. And, you know, that always gets people, you know, riled up. And
I thought it was a good question, too. I wish John had entertained it and thought about it, because it was a good question.
So as of this point, I have still not actually seen the full press conference. What was the actual question?
The question Luke posed to him was essentially like, okay, you're 30 now. You just turned 30. What do you make of the last decade of your life? Success, not a success? And I think that would have been an interesting thing, the question for Jones to navigate. So, I thought it was a fair question. I don't get what the deal is. I don't know what their backstory is or anything. And you never want to see that. It's just kind of an unprofessional moment. But Luke took it in stride. And so, you know, such is life.
Yeah.
My perspective was, hey, at least he got to ask the question, right? And some of us aren't fortunate even to ask the question. So he got that.
I would agree. And you should be there being able to ask questions, cover the show and all that. And yeah, it's still a travesty that's still not done. But what you mentioned, you know, fighters being, I don't say hostile, but they've told you, you know, I'm not, don't like you and had some issues. For those that haven't kind of been in the world of interviewing fighters and so on, how have you explain how you go about kind of, I'll say, cooler heads prevailing, unlike the dog in the background?
Yeah, I'm sorry about that. I'm trying to mute as I go along here. If it's an issue, I can try and put her away, but she makes a lot of noise.
No worries. So
how do you navigate it? I mean, look, you have to – first things first, try and be fair. You know, it's not like you're going after people and trying to goad them into having reactionary responses. If you're fair in your questions and your approach, you know, you can't really do much when people have a response like that. Sometimes you have to ask questions that aren't the most comfortable. Another way to phrase them is adversarial. That comes with the territory. And I'll tell you, the vast majority of the fighters and the people I've worked with around in MMA and covered have generally been gracious enough, even answer very difficult questions that I've posed to them. But I think if you're a reporter and you're in that situation, you never want to be the story. You never really want to be put in a situation where you engage in a back and forth and all of a sudden it becomes about you and somehow your question is more important than anything else. You know, let their response flavor and sort of dictate how people view them. And, I think sometimes the media a lot of times actually gets, you know, bad rap, and it's fun for people to pick on us. Look, we're in a fight sport. We're in something that's really, in the grand scheme of things, not very important. A lot of reporters who are reporting out extremely important details about how the world works face much more severe circumstances. And sometimes and oftentimes more severe repercussions. So, you know, I think we have to all keep it in perspective of what we're actually doing here. But you're hoping that if you take the right approach, that people will respond to your questions. You know, look, I've had plenty of interviews where I thought I asked totally valid questions and people were giving me one or two word answers and it's just not there. It depends on the interview subject a lot of times and depends on the moment as well. So, you just have to sort of realize that it's not about you. You know, it's just not about you. And there are some media figures who like to grandstand, and I'm not talking MMA. I'm just talking across the board. There are people who like to make it about themselves, like somehow they're important or holier than thou. And I don't subscribe to that school of thought. I've been thrown in some situations where all of a sudden I've become the story, and I don't really like that. I don't want to be that. I'm never going to shy away from those things, but it's not something I seek. And so I think if you avoid that and handle the situation professionally, in the end, even people who may not like you will find some reason to respect you in the way that you operate, and they're usually gracious enough to entertain your questions.
And I think that's been a big change in media, I'd say, over the last 10 years, 5 years. I mean, really, like, I remember when I was going to school for journalism and kind of learning this, even in high school, it was never about putting yourself first, as you mentioned. It's all about the interview subject. There, you're helping tell the story. It's up to you to convey that once you know, start clacking your fingers on a keyboard and doing your interviews and doing all that. But in this era, I think social media has brought out. I think the fact that more people are now comfortable with anyone can do a YouTube video, a podcast, all this type of stuff, and people can just put this stuff out there and they see these other people become stars. They're like, huh, I can do that. I don't have to do my research. I can just give opinions or do this. I think, unfortunately, a byproduct of that is that there are those of us that when we get in these interviews and have that, guys like you that have that background and have that ability to ask and talk and get those stories, I think sometimes, you're right, the media in general gets a bad rap because, you know, they're so used to, oh, clickbait, or you're just trying to antagonize or try and do this. And almost all this other bad stuff that happens out there, unfortunately, gets transferred over to people trying to just tell a good story or try to get someone's story out without any agenda. I think everyone kind of gets lumped into one bucket.
Yeah, no question. I mean, and lots of people painting with broad brushes out there. And I don't like the clickbait stuff, and I don't like the talking head stuff. The punditry is kind of out of control.
Yeah.
And we've seen a move in journalism, especially in sports. I mean, especially in sports, towards that sort of hot take. It's not about going out and sourcing stories. And even if you do, it's one source and anonymous, and somehow that suffices. So, it really depends. It depends on the level of integrity that you have as a journalist and what you're reporting out. You know, if you're reporting out something that's really important and you need to double and triple check your sources and confirm and all those sorts of things, it's incumbent on you as a reporter to do that. Otherwise you get yourself in trouble real quick. And the folks who sort of just focus on opinion The barrier to entry is there's no barrier to entry at any point. I mean, at this stage, it's like you fire up the YouTube channel or you hop on social media and anybody can have a voice and an opinion. And we've seen so many reports and rumors and just in the MMA world that turn out not to be true. And there's no real repercussion. A lot of times people don't even put their real names out there in terms of what they're reporting. And it just sort of gets picked up in the social media sphere. You know, those of us who try and do it the right way, you know, even in our small little realm, it's harder, and sometimes the prices to pay are more severe. But, you know, if you're going to be a journalist and you're going to do the job, you know, it's sort of incumbent on you to do it the right way, even at the very sort of baseline journalism 101 levels. You know, it's not about like going out and doing deep enterprise reporting and exposing deep dark secrets of these, you know, people. You know, sometimes it's that, but that's a very hard thing to do. It takes resources and time and energy and the wherewithal and some guts sometimes. So, you know, there's all sorts of different levels of reporting and different levels of journalism. The clickbait, the opinion, I don't really even classify that as journalism. That's just punditry.
Last time you were on, I believe it was fall of last year, we talked a lot about Ali Inoki, and obviously people can hear your interview with Dave and Brian on this very site for the basic kind of the background and all that stuff. But I heard Ali Inoki get brought up and your name got brought up again when Mayweather McGregor got announced, and people just trying to make any crazy comparisons, any type of like tie-ins that they could. And that fight got brought up. So it almost like, did you get a few more interview requests and a little bit more interest, a revived interest in the book when that got announced?
I did. And it didn't hurt that it was right around the anniversary of the match again, end of June. So the timeline kind of worked. So, Ariel Helwani had me on his show, and Chris Jericho. I did an interview actually with him last year, but he happened to put it out right around this time. And for him, it worked out too because of the Mayweather McGregor thing. I've had some other interests from different people because of that tie-in, and I'm not complaining. I mean, I appreciate the discussion and people bringing it up. And I think you can make some comparisons. Some of them don't work. They're a bit of a stretch. But for me, any reason to sort of bring up the book and bring it up as a topic, and I love that Conor McGregor actually mentioned it in the first press conference. You know, I was like, ooh, is he going to do this every single time? And he didn't. But, you know, it would have been nice if he did. But, you know, it gives me a chance to say, hey, look, this is what I wrote, and this is actually an important event in the history of not only mixed martial arts, but combat sports. And, you know, I think it's something worth looking at. And if you want, you can try and draw some parallels because – yeah, you can find them. They're not too hard. You know, this is its own thing. It does go down in sort of that category of an event fight, a novelty, a one-off, a sort of a crazy thing. And we don't have much of that in this era. You know, 30 years ago, there was much more of that in the 70s, especially. So, I mean, it's like George Foreman was fighting four people in Toronto on ABC Wide World of Sports. You know, it was like one of those things in a different time, a different era. So this harkens back to that. And I think people made that connection. Mm.
You've probably talked about Mayweather McGregor to death, but give me 60 seconds on what you make of everything you've seen so far.
Pretty astounding that Conor McGregor has put himself in this position. I think that's the first thing. One, just as a fighter, no matter what your discipline is, to have gone from where he was 5 years ago to where he is today is just an incredible story. Two, again, sort of the merging of these combat sports. I think anytime you have a mixed style competition against a boxer, it seems to generate public attention, it seems to generate interest. I sure would love it to be a mixed fight, but it's a boxing fight, so it's its own thing. And three, you know, the fact that it is boxing, the fact that it is Floyd Mayweather going to 15-0, fighting a guy who's never had a pro boxing fight, and the fact that it's just such an apparent money grab, and, you know, the whole thing with the IRS. I mean, it's so transparent for what it is. And initially, I was sort of up in arms about it, and I was like, oh, this is a joke. But I've backed off. I've kind of like learned a lesson from the book that I wrote. It's like these event fights, these moments, they're okay. You know, that they're not a statement on one, you know, on MMA or boxing or combat sports. It's Floyd Mayweather and Conor McGregor coming together in a combat sports event, and the public sure seems invested in it. And so that's my takeaway, just in a quick wrap. The fight itself, I mean, I'm not expecting Floyd Mayweather to lose. I would be shocked if it happened. And it would be what a sporting event. What a sporting event that would turn out to be if somehow Conor McGregor did the Mystic Mac thing on Floyd Mayweather. Are you kidding?
Right.
Wow.
Yeah. And I think this, to me, just illustrates how much in this world of our eyes and attention's being pulled everywhere in every type of medium, no matter what, that there are certain things that just stand out, and is this mass of people are like, you know what? I'm interested in that. That's getting my attention. And it's fascinating because people like you and myself may be like, oh my God, we see it for what it is. But a lot of people also kind of see it for what it is, but they just don't care. They're looking to be entertained and taken away from their, you know, their 9-to-5 job or something like that. And they're just like, you know what? I want to be entertained. And I don't think the fight is going to be that entertaining, but I think that just the spectacle and all this stuff, it is just such a unique thing on this scale that I just think there's a group of people and millions of people are going to hit that buy button on the remote. And they just want to be taken away for a night. And, you know, it's hard to disagree with that. It's hard to tell them you're doing the wrong thing. It's just, you know, it happens time and time again. We have had this discussion of how pay-per-view is changing so much. But, you know, I think we're going to get to a point where these things don't happen anymore. And we're going to look back and be like, oh, yeah, you remember this? You remember this? And the big event is going to be, especially in fight sports, I think is going to come to a close at some point here in the next few years.
It's, you know, it could, it seems to be trending that way, and asking people to shell out even more money than they already do, is a difficult thing where, you know, I think we've seen the UFC, their pay-per-view numbers have not been what they were. And when Conor fights, sure. But when everybody else fights, it just seems to be not the kind of attraction it was in the past. And I think there's some risk here. Look, boxing took a hit after the Mayweather-Pacquiao fight. That was a bout that had so many expectations and had been in the zeitgeist for so long, and now we're sort of like thrown into this whirlwind of Mayweather-McGregor. I think no matter what, it's going to be fun. You know, whereas Pacquiao-Mayweather ended up not being that great a fight, and people felt like they were fleeced in the end, and it didn't live up to the hype. No matter what happens, I think Conor McGregor will make sure that this is an entertaining fight. You know, whether he goes out in a shield or something crazy happens, or he's exposed. But I think he will ensure that people will leave feeling like they didn't get fleeced. That's my sense. That's just a guess, obviously. I have no idea. But that's my sense of it as we approach it. And I think that's important because, you know, if it comes in and it's apparent that this is just a cash grab and he's totally outmatched and Floyd can kind of pick him apart and it's boring for 12 rounds, people are going to be really pissed. And this may be sort of the end of pay-per-view. You know, I think Floyd going from the Pacquiao fight then to this Mayweather cash grab event fight, you know, it's going to be very difficult for people, for audiences to get attracted to regular boxing. And that's a shame because, you know, a couple weeks later you have Triple G and Canelo, and that's an amazing boxing bout, just a great boxing bout between tremendous boxers. And you wonder how much of the public attention it can actually grasp in the wake of this thing. So it does feel like Mayweather McGregor is sort of swallowing up everything in combat sports until it happens. Mm-hmm. 214 has sort of been a victim to that as well.
So let's shift our attention to 214. And this is the card we've been asking for. I think this has been a really strange and down year in a lot of ways for the sport. Very bizarre with the McGregor stuff and obviously no Rousey and just this continued, where are we going with this promotion? Coming off an amazing 2016 and 2017 has kind of been, you know, hit or miss in a lot of spots, but this is, you know, knock on wood that no one gets hurt. There's no USADA violations, anything like that, that comes Saturday night. If this is card remains intact, this is for a pay-per-view, you're asking people to shell out $60. This card is well worth $60, and arguably this is your value for $100. Coming up on Saturday night, we have obviously Jones versus Cormier in the rematch in the main event. We have Tyron Woodley taking on Damian Maia for the welterweight title co-main event. Cyborg Justino taking on Tanya Evinger. Robbie Lawler versus Donald Cerrone is fourth from the top. That is pretty crazy. And finally, Jimmy Manuwa against Volkan Ozdemir. A fight that just kind of came out of nowhere with Volkan scoring a huge knockout in his last win. Manuwa kind of floating around that top contender spot for a main card. You know, I don't want to be too promotional when it comes to you know, UFC type of stuff, but it's hard to deny. This is an amazing main card.
It's tremendous, and it's desperately needed. The UFC hasn't had an event like this all year, and you know, here we are. I don't want to get too hyped up because anything can happen within 24 hours of the fight with John Jones. I mean, he's proven that. But if everything holds together, it's a great card. You know, it's rare that you have three title fights for UFC. Once in a while, it happens. But I expect all three title fights to be interesting in their own ways. And then, I mean, Lawler Cerrone is just a great fight. I think the undercard on FXX is there's some solid action there. So yeah, this is a kind of UFC card that fans have come to expect and have not really had in a while. And I think it's nice to see that. And when, you know, sometimes they tend to be on the hyperbolic side, but you know, when Dana White says this is the best card we've done all year and one of the best cards we've ever done, you can't really argue that.
Well, I would agree. What do you make of what you've seen from John Jones so far in both the, you know, the press conference today, being Wednesday, the, some of the interviews leading up? I saw you mention a very interesting comment made by John Jones. He's not talking to Dana White at this point. Basically sees Ari Emanuel as his boss. What have you kind of made of both, you know, his body language, if you're into that type of thing, or just what he's saying? What do you think his mindset is, and what do you expect to see from him on Saturday?
Well, it's hard to get a read on Jones because he's always been kind of slippery that way. The first time I ever interviewed him, I think it was in 2011. He had just won the title, and it was in Los Angeles, and he's talking to me about all these things that he wants to do and how important it is for him to be a role model. And, you know, he has an offer from Budweiser, but he doesn't want to take it because of the conflicts with being involved with alcohol. And you sort of hear him say these things. And now that knowing what we know, it's like, well, what are you talking about? This is not who you were at all. And so when I sort of see him talk about what he wants to be or where he wants to go, I don't put any stock on that. I was like, where are you right now, John Jones? And all I know is where he is right now. He's in tremendous shape and he's days away from a really important fight. And when he does step in the octagon, you know, he has been unparalleled. So I see a guy who's pretty confident. I mean, despite it all, just one fight in 2.5 years, I still see a guy who's really confident. I see him in some ways going through this, you know, these machinations of, you know, maybe I'm not necessarily a good person, but I'm a great fighter. I'm a better fighter than Daniel Cormier. And he keeps hammering that himself, keeps hammering away at that and that idea. He has to be that unbeaten killer. He has to be, because if he doesn't have that, what is John Jones at this point? So he's sort of really holding on to that idea. And I think more than anything, I've felt that coming from him as the fight has been built up. And he's done media and then during fight week, you know, for him, it's all about I'm untouchable. You know, I don't know if he's going to wear the unbroken t-shirt because he's had some moments, but that idea still permeates through him. It's like, I am still that guy. I am still that lion. And, I think this is just my supposition, just a guess, but I feel like he's saying all these things, but he still has to prove it to himself against Cormier. And for all the stuff that he's talked about Cormier, I think he sees a real challenge because he felt the real challenge. So the first three rounds against Daniel Cormier in 2015, that was a hard three rounds for John Jones, no doubt about it. And so he knows this is not any kind of pushover, and he knows it's not OSP. And I don't think he's going to be surprised like he was against Alexander Gustafsson. He knows the challenge in front of him, and he's sort of convinced himself that he's the guy to handle Cormier. And Cormier is just going to be another great challenger in the line of John Jones, is something he said. And so I kind of believe him there, but at the same time, I feel like he is in a position where he needs to show himself in the first 10 minutes of the fight that he's still John Jones, for whatever it is. Maybe the partying and the drugs and all this sort of stuff made him and made his personality a certain way. And if you get away from those things, you know, they can weigh on you and weigh on anybody, you know. So I think he's got to show in the first 10 minutes that he's still John Jones, and I expect him to. But again, not going to be easy. And I guess that's the most intriguing part about this whole fight to me, is that Daniel Cormier can beat John Jones. And that, you don't say that a lot about John Jones' opponents, but I think Daniel Cormier can legitimately do that. And John knows that. I think even though he says, you know, you can't touch me, I already beat you once, that was a while ago. And their trajectory in lives, both of them have taken far different paths. And yet here they are again. My sense of it is that Yeah, he's saying all these things and he believes them, but he still has to prove it to himself before he's really there. And again, I expect him to. But that's what I'm getting from John. That's sort of what he's putting off as the fight approaches.
Yeah, and I'm getting this sense of just anger and just determination. Just there's this just look, and he could be putting on a show. But there's just in these interviews, you just get this sense of intensity, and just that he wants to prove to everyone, and again, like you mentioned, including himself, that he is still the man. He is the guy that we saw decimate Shogun Hua all those years ago, the guy that just, you know, submitted Lyoto Machida and just let him slump to the mat, and just that unbelievable visual that we'll never forget back in that title defense, and just the guy that has gone through hell and has come through and is just essentially undefeated, aside from that one fluke loss. But yeah, and just that, I think you're right. I think that first 10 minutes, the first 5-10 minutes, whatever it is, he's gonna show himself to improve to himself that I'm still everything that I think I am. On the flip side, with Cormier, you know, the big thing on him has always been he can't win the big one. And obviously he comes into this fight as a light heavyweight champion. He has done all the right things. He has fought tough fights. That Gustafson fight was amazing. The UFC 200, the fight against Anderson Silva was a little bit of a slip up, but that was obviously a very strange circumstance how he came out. That was weird. The fact that he's, you know, it's been a long time since we've seen him. I still think he's underappreciated in a lot of ways for what he's done in the sport. I wonder what happens to his psyche if he loses Saturday night, and then also kind of what happens to his legacy. And I think with a win here, he completely ascends to this kind of this reserve spot, I think, in a lot of ways. But if he loses, it's almost like, yeah, well, you know, he was really great, but he couldn't ever beat the guy like John Jones. I wonder if you, what you think of that?
Yeah. And that's the truth. I mean, if he doesn't beat Jones, then people are going to say, oh, well, you know, he was good, but not that great. And he probably won't get his due, even considering what he did at heavyweight. I've always actually thought that he was a better heavyweight than a light heavyweight, although he's been a very good light heavyweight. So, look, at this point, he's 38. Like, you know, his mission always was to be the best. If he falters against Jones here, that's a difficult thing to recover from. I think it took him a little while to recover from the first fight, but he has done that. I think he's an improved fighter over that guy. He's been through a lot of wars and hotly contested battles, and I think they've made him sharper and a better fighter and more prepared for this moment. But if things don't go his way, and if Jones actually takes it to him and really sort of dominates him, yeah, I think DC will have a gut check. And you wonder if all of a sudden for him it'll become more about, well, let's just have some fun and make some money. He's a guy who loves pro wrestling, mm-hmm. kind of gets like hanging around and putting on a show. And he's got that personality, and the UFC certainly needs that. I don't know where he goes as a competitor, because this is the peak of his competitive prospect. I mean, you don't get more competitive than John Jones. And so if you can't do that, but you beat everybody else in the division, well, you're second best here. What are you going to do? Go up to heavyweight again, perhaps. But then there's talk about Jones going up to heavyweight. So, you know, I think it'll be very difficult on Daniel Cormier if he doesn't win. Even if he puts on a really good showing, I think it'll be difficult for him to handle that idea that, you know, he just couldn't get over the hurdle against Jones. But again, you know, that's just how this thing works. There was a lot of great competitors who were out there trying to beat Michael Jordan, mm-hmm. and they just couldn't do it. And you know, we remember them fondly for who they were, but you'll never think of them as Jordan ever. And I think Jones, if he goes out and beats Cormier, he's got that killer. We don't have to like these great winners. And most of the time we don't like these great winners. I mean, we come to respect them, but certainly amongst their peers, amongst even the, you know, the people close to them, you know, great winners and great competitors are selfish people. And Jones is, like, just seems inherently selfish. He lives a selfish life, and maybe he has to be this great. I don't know. But for Cormier, he's lived a life. He's got a family. He's had much harder moments than losing a fight. I mean, he's lost children. So, you know, he's a guy that I think would move on to the next stage of his career pretty quickly. But I do think it would weigh on him. You know, he's that kind of competitor.
So looking at the rest of the card, obviously we went over the main card, and you mentioned this really fun prelim card. What else really stands out to you as something you really are interested in seeing how it plays out on Saturday?
You know, Tyron Woodley against Damian Maia to me is just a tactical, really intriguing mixed martial arts fight that a lot of people may end up thinking, oh, it was a boring contest. It would, but I guarantee I'm going to be on the edge of my seat. And I don't know if it's the kind of fight that you're going to go afterwards and watch 10 times. But in that moment that you're watching, I think it's going to be super high tension. I'd expect when they lock up or when Maia does something that threatens Woodley, you know, that's, you're going to really feel that. So I'm excited for that fight because I do think that that's a classy contest, a deserving championship contest. Tyron Woodley's proven to be a very good champion in the welterweight division. Going out and beating Damian Maia would set him up for big things. If you believe Dana White, and there's plenty of reasons not to, but if you believe Dana White, then GSP would be next. So I think there's a lot at stake here. So for me, that's the top one. And then you have like some really interesting stuff. I mean, Lawler Cerrone in its own ways, it's just completely compelling. These are two guys who come to war always. And you know, up and down the card, you can look at it. So I do think you can speak to the depth of 214 and kind of pick and choose and find matchups all up and down the card that are going to be fun and compelling. But for me, if you had to point to one other thing, I mean, that Woodley Maia fight, I love that fight.
Yeah, good points. And with Lawler Cerrone, you know, Lawler, I'm fascinated with these type of fights because you really kind of see where they are. And with guys like Lawler, you know, with Lawler and Cerrone are both, I would say, closer to the end of the career than obviously the beginning. They both have made some money, had some fame. Obviously, Cerrone has never won a title, and Lawler obviously coming off that really fun run at welterweight that just made him a darling in the eyes of many UFC fans, perhaps to the detriment of Tyron Woodley, but that's been discussed quite a bit. But you really get to see, you know, since that he's taken some time off, and since that loss, you know, does he still have that fire? Does he still want to really go for the title? Is he looking, you know, how does he look in this fight? And with Cerrone, you know, he's been a victim of some injuries and obviously some bad luck along the way, just losses, some great wins. This is to me, a real gut check fight as far as how, like, what do these guys have left and how much are they willing to give it to us over a 15-minute period? And this is, I love what you said about Woodley and Maia, and I agree there's going to be high tension there. I am very, very, very interested to see, not from just the action itself, but just how do both guys look in this Lawler Cerrone fight? I'm fascinated by it.
Yeah, I think lots of question marks there. I saw a stat today that I think in his last seven fights, Robbie Lawler has taken 670 significant strikes. Oh. And then you sort of remember those wars. I mean, the McDonald fight was crazy. Both bouts with Hendricks were nuts. And then the devastation that he felt against Woodley. It's a really bad knockout. So you wonder, now Robbie's an older guy. I mean, even as long as he's been around, I still always kind of consider Robbie Lawler a kid, you know, because he just started so young and he's so fresh-faced. But he's been around a long time and he's taken a lot of damage. And same with Donald Cerrone. At this stage of their careers, you wonder what both of them have left to give, but they're warriors and I expect nothing less. I think the crowd expects nothing less. I think the fight is Lawler's to lose. He's the more natural fighter in this weight class. He's the larger guy. He's the heavier hitter. I think he's the better fighter of the two of them. And so I would expect Lawler to find a way to win. There's a lot of intrigue here. But for sure, you know, I think the loser is all of a sudden in a really precarious spot. You know, I don't know how much longer Robbie Lawler just wants to do this just to fight. He's done this for a long time. And Cerrone, you know, I don't know how many more miles can he rack up if he goes out and takes a tough one, you know? So it's, there's a lot of pressure on both of them, I think, to perform. And, the stakes are pretty high and a win for either, you know, kind of puts them right there in that top five mix at 170. And, you know, depending on what GSP does and what happens to Woodley, you know, maybe not too far away from a pretty big money fight. So, you know, I think this is definitely, for me, it's the third most intriguing fight on the card. Not to take anything away from anyone else, but for all the reasons you laid out, I certainly feel that way.
Yep. And also in the prelims, Lamas and Jason Knight. Jason Knight, we'll see if this is too big of a jump for him in competition. He's been a guy that's been fighting on these prelims and look really good. And somebody that has raised a lot of eyebrows, opened up some eyes at featherweight and a fast-rising prospect against Lamas, who is a guy that has been there and I think is a great test for Knight at this point in his career. And then this catchweight fight, Aljamain Sterling, who is kind of an interesting guy. I think there's been a lot of pressure put on him since that free agent signing by the UFC, but kind of just how that whole process went down. It was very in the open, and I thought that, you know, maybe he might – he probably thought he was going to get a little bit more higher offers at the time against a guy in Henan Barao who we really don't know – we still really know kind of where he's at this stage in his career. He's you know, far away from title relevancy, but just kind of interesting to see, you know, the weight cuts over the years, what effect that's taken, and what style of fighter he is going to be now in this, this, you know, second stage, third stage of his career, whatever you want to call it. This is an interesting fight because I just don't know – I don't know what you're going to get out of either guy in Sterling and Barao.
Yeah, well, one of the most amazing things about Barao is his takedown defense percentage. I mean, what, 100%, right? No one's ever taken him down. So you figure Sterling has to do that in order to win this fight. And Sterling is not, yeah, there was a lot of talk about after he signed that deal and sort of, you know, him negotiating back and forth with different companies and what he was going to do and his return to the UFC. He hasn't quite hit that. And maybe there's more room for him to progress as a fighter. This is the kind of fight that he needs to show that. Barao's a classy fighter and very good. I do wonder how much those Dillashaw fights took out of him because I, you know, and the weight cutting and all that, but definitely the Dillashaw fights had a effect on him. There's no question about it. And he went out and won his last one and looked pretty good doing it. And I think he probably, you know, could let go and feel a sigh of relief. But, you know, for him to take on Aljamain Sterling here at 140, you know, it's kind of a weird fight. It's a catchweight fight. What does that mean for Barao's future at 135? Because what is he saying? He can't really hack it at 45. He has to go down to 35, but the commission won't let him fight there. So he's in no man's land. There's a lot of things to wonder about. I think this fight, there will be storylines that come out of the result of this fight that I think will be interesting.
And finally, we'll ask you finally wrap up on 214. What will people be talking the most about from this card on Monday?
Yeah. Well, one thing we haven't talked about is Cyborg. So,
oh, yes.
You know, I think people will talk about Cormier Jones. I mean, that's the fight sets up that way. The rivalry, the hatred, the fact that they're both so skilled and so good and such hard-nosed competitors and the stakes involved, I would guess that that's going to be the talking point. Woodley seems to have a way to get people to talk about him on big cards. So if he goes out and finishes Damian Maia spectacularly, which is possible. I mean, look what he did. It was early in his career, and Andre Galvao is not the mixed martial artist that Maia is, but similar styles maybe, similar sort of outcome potentially. But Cyborg against Tonya Evinger, I think, will be something that on fight night people will just marvel at. Tonya Evinger is probably too tough for her own good in this fight, and I expect Chris Cyborg to really beat her up. And probably make it kind of ugly. So that, you know, that's always the thing with Cyborg. And I think she has her own fan base and her own following, and she's been doing this for a long time. And it's about time that she gets that crack at 145 in the UFC. She's dealt with a lot of garbage to get here. So, you know, I think that's a fight definitely worth talking about and worth looking at. Evinger is not a featherweight. She's a bantamweight. She's tough and she's a good grappler. But I just have a hard time seeing her take down Cyborg and controlling her on the floor and finding a submission or what. I just don't see that happening. I see her getting beat up. And at the end of the day, probably Chris will get some headlines. But like I said, Jones Cormier is the thing that's driving this show, as it should. And if somehow Daniel Cormier beats John Jones, then the UFC has set themselves up for the biggest trilogy in their history. And it looks like the biggest rivalry in the UFC history. And boy, then all bets are off then, because Jones' veneer of invincibility would have disappeared, and Cormier will just own him in the media, and we'll see what John Jones is really made of at that point. I don't think he's going to go Rousey on us, but, you know, we'll see if he kind of crumbles under that idea that, you know what, I'm not as good as I thought I was. I don't know if DC can deliver that, but if he does, that certainly people will be talking about that on Monday.
You can hear more of Josh's breakdown of UFC 214 on The Outsiders, his podcast with Jeff Sherwood, currently on episode 38. And I wanted to ask you before I let you go, how's your return to podcasting been? How's the experience?
It's fun. You know, it's Jeff and I just shooting the shit, if I can say that.
Yeah.
And yeah, certainly Jeff and I have known each other for a long time. I was very grateful to him during my days at SureDog when I worked for him, and he gave me a great opportunity, and we have a good rapport, and it's fun. And for me, you know, I love doing this stuff because it doesn't feel like work. You know, I believe me, I love to write a good story, but that's work. Transcribing and sitting down and framing a story and putting it together and, you know, editing, that's work. This is fun. You know, this is how I feel about it. And I enjoy doing it with Jeff, and we have a good time.
Awesome. And you can get that. Obviously, the link is on Josh's Twitter. It's a Patreon account. So, you know, open up the wallet, open up the PayPal.
$3 a month.
Yeah.
$3 a month.
Fork over a couple bucks. Listen, our listeners are used to paying for content, so they should be willing to give a few bucks to you. So I think that's more than reasonable. More than reasonable. Well, thank you for returning, Josh Gross. Before we let you go, give you a chance to plug anything else. Obviously, you just talked about the podcast, but where's your coverage coming up this weekend? And obviously, where can people buy the book? And the floor is yours.
Yeah, thanks. I'll be writing for The Guardian this weekend, so I'll have a preview up on Friday and then post-fight stuff up on Sunday and Monday. I have the podcast with Jeff on Patreon, as we said, and then the book, Ali versus Inoki, which is something people listening to this would probably have a real interest in. If you want to get more of a backstory on why Mayweather McGregor and, you know, is intriguing on some larger picture combat sports scales, maybe that book would appeal to you. You can get on Amazon or in bookstores. And, you know, that's been a fun thing to be a part of. It was my first book, and I really have appreciated the response that people have given it, especially, you know, guys like you, Josh, and Dave Meltzer's a character in the book. He's actually like in the book as a recurring character. He kind of important guy there. So, I was happy to do that. And check me out on Twitter, at @YAY_YEE.
And you're right. Dave Meltzer certainly is a character.
No, yes, he is.
No doubt about it. Josh Gross, thank you so much for returning to Josh Nathan's Punch Out this week.
All right. Thank you.
All right. Big thanks to Josh Gross for dropping by. You can follow him on Twitter, buy his book on Amazon, and also check out the show, MMA Outsiders, on Patreon. Lowest $3 a month. You can listen to he and Jeff Sherwood talk about two MMA journalism pioneers and covering the sport for as long as they have. And they're on, again, episode 38, $3 a month. Hey, try it out. Check out the archives. See what you think. And, you know, I think those guys have a lot of interesting things to say, different perspective than a lot of people covering the sport. So obviously give them a listen and let Josh know you heard them on our show. So let's see. UFC 214, we talked all about that. However, there's another angle to UFC 214 that Josh and I didn't even talk about, but myself and another guest did. And that show is going to drop on Friday. It's a little bit of a surprise, because I'm hoping that another person can actually join the show and talk about his perspective. And I'm being a little bit vague because I think this is kind of a fun surprise I have coming out on Friday. So enjoy the show. Look forward to at least you're going to get a podcast on Friday regardless. This one, and you're going to get one regardless on Friday. It's just a question if it's one person or if it's two. So Let your mind kind of wander about who it could be. Actually, don't let it wander too much. I don't know if you'll actually guess it, but it's going to be a little bit a fun, tongue-in-cheek look at UFC 214 from someone you might have not expected to hear from on our airwaves. So without further ado, I'm going to bid you all a good night. Big thanks to Josh Gross. Thanks to all of you for listening. Thanks to all of you for subscribing. This has been Josh Nason's Punch-Out, and until next time, insert catchphrase here.